Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, where the editorial brain trust of America's favorite libertarian magazine gathers each Monday to yak about the news. I am Matt Welch, joined by my colleagues, Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Hi, gang.
Howdy.
Happy Monday.
It's always a pleasure to be here with you, Matt Welch.
We're going to talk about the mostly COVID-free coronavirus rescue package here in a second. But first, I want to tell you about a podcast. Politics Then and Now examines the ideas, events, and people that have molded the modern political world and continue to influence things through to the present day. Delves into American history, how the Greco-Roman world influenced America from its founding to today, and the political philosophy that sculpted American ideals. Politics Then and Now will help you understand and question the role of government for once. What was the revolution really about? What are rights? What are we entitled to as citizens? What is freedom? Man, if you've ever wondered about these things, Politics Then and Now is the podcast for you. Check it out on any podcast platform. You'll be glad you did. Okay, so at the risk of leaving some crucial Ted Cruz in Cancun traffic on the table, I wanted to start today by talking about the $1.9 trillion American rescue plan, so-called, which is the signature legislative proposal by the new Biden administration, and will do more to shape economics and governance than, you know, your photoshopped image of Ted pulling his carry-on through the Mars rescue video or whatever the hell. Peter, you wrote a piece last week.
What did you think we were rescuing?
Like a narwhal?
Exactly.
Maybe?
It's a narwhal on Mars. It's really... Anyways, Peter, last week, and even to this day, I see people encountering the piece that you wrote last week with a sense of shock, possibly because of what's in the headline. So I'll read the headline. Biden's coronavirus relief package has almost nothing to do with the coronavirus, unquote headline. Start off, if you would, how can that be, and what are the implications of that?
Yeah, I mean, that's in some ways the headline. It's like, that's it. That's the tweet, right? That's the whole response here is there's a $1.9 trillion in spending and very little of it is devoted directly to coronavirus relief in the coronavirus relief package. So about 1% is devoted to vaccines, about 5% is for directly relevant public health measures. And then you have just a bunch of other stuff that has been thrown in here, including a bunch of pre-existing Democratic policy priorities. You've got expansions of Obamacare and changes to Medicaid. I think a really notable example here is the way that this provides money for schools. So we've talked a lot about school reopenings on this podcast, and Joe Biden has positioned himself as somebody who is in favor of reopening schools just so long as schools get the money that they really need to reopen. So this provides about $170 billion in grants for kind of education stuff, and $128 billion or so of that is for schools to reopen. Except that only $6 billion of that will be spent this year, in part because we've already spent $100 billion or so on schools, and most of that money hasn't been spent yet. And I should say, this is only $6 billion of that is going to be spent this fiscal year. And then we're only going to have about another $30 or $35 billion of that in the next fiscal year, and then the rest of it rolls out over a decade period. And so Biden's argument is, this is essential. It's urgent. We have to do this right now. We have to go really big right now. Otherwise, there's just no way schools can reopen. And then his package, the actual details of it, say otherwise. They say, let's not spend this money for another year or two or three. And it just doesn't make any sense at all as policy or as a political argument.
Nick, let's steel man this one, Nick, which is to say, maybe this is what happens when you spend lots of money from the government. It's hard to spend money fast. I mean, I remember Peter writing a story about the stimulus post facto, looking back at the 2009 stimulus. And it's kind of hard to get them shovel ready projects going there. Are we being unfair by, criticizing this bill for not, you know, dumping all the money into vaccines right away or fixing all the ventilation systems in America right now.
It would be kind of nice if we started spending the money that has already been allocated before we start doubling and tripling down on the next tranches of COVID relief, Matt Welch. And I think, you know, that's a big problem. One of the lessons, which was clearly not learned for a very long period of time in the bailout during the financial crisis, is that there are no shovel-ready jobs. That was the whole thing. You know, we were talking about we needed a stimulus because the economy was in the shitter. There are so many shovel-ready jobs. The real problem is we don't have enough shovels. And it turned out that just simply wasn't true. With the school stuff in particular, what we know is that much of what they're talking about here has nothing to do with safety, which should be like the overriding concern, because schools are not vectors of infection or anything like that. And, you know, if we can tear ourselves away from Ted Cruz on vacation for just a second, we should be going back again and again to the ways in which the teachers' unions in particular have done everything they can to avoid going to work for the jobs that they are paid, whether that's online teaching or actually in person, which it should be. And that, you know, those are the things that we should be discussing. There are ways to roll out vaccines faster. You know, Reason has a ton of articles about that. And that is ramping up. You know, like people are, the vaccine rollout has been screwed up from its inception through its execution. But that is actually like delivering results in a way that so many other parts of this are not. The other thing that I think is worth talking about all of this is whether or not any of this stuff is actually targeted to people who need it. And in general, that is not, it is not the case. And the one of the biggest problems, I think, with COVID is that it has, even in many ways, washed away the idea that we should be targeting this stuff. It's just we're in such dismal shape. We've just got to, you know, get as many helicopters up in the air and drop as many, you know, helicopter dollars everywhere, as opposed to being a little bit more surgical about it, which would be more in keeping with what's actually going on in America.
A couple quick follow-ups to both of your previous comments. One is that the overall price tag of K-12 imagined in this bill is probably $200 billion, because there's an extra $350 billion earmarked just to help out states with their budgets. And about 20% of state budgets go to K-12 education. And there's a kind of a list of talking points of what they want to break down that spending on. And the total amount of that breakdown was $200 billion. And the startling thing is that 80% of it goes to personnel. It's hiring teachers, hiring extra people. This is where the 6-foot rule of kids and adults all have to be 6 feet separated, thereby creating smaller classes. That's where that comes in specifically, because it requires more teachers, more janitors, more bus drivers. It's fascinating to see that. The other thing about vaccine rollouts, which now that I qualify for one, I'm keenly interested in the process in New York, which is hilariously awful. But that we're like at 0.5% of the population has been vaccinated, which is like terrible, infuriating, and slow, and also better than everywhere in Europe. Europe is an absolute catastrophe. Western Europe, which sometimes people are holding up as the, you know, the model. Well, you know, the UK is a little bit
ahead of us.
They
have such good bread.
I mean, the reason that Europe has been going
bread in Western Europe.
Yeah, the bread's great. We should just note the reason that it's going so slow in Europe is that they just completely blew the vaccine purchasing process. And so they just messed around trying to negotiate drug prices, and these vaccines are not super expensive. They're actually much less expensive than vaccines typically are. And so they spent a bunch of time trying to get the lowest price for these vaccines. And it's, and they have, in the process, just cost their economies huge, huge, huge amounts of money that wasn't worth it at all. And so the one thing, you know, I have often been quite critical of Trump and of the coronavirus response there, but they got the vaccine process going not great, not perfectly, definitely could have been better, and probably even could have spent more money, but they did it a lot better than Europe did.
Catherine, as an editor of this fine publication and someone who pays attention to the news, I would invite you to express your feelings about why we got to read a libertarian magazine to find out what's in this bill. or to find out like what happened to the other money that we spent. It's as if reading newspapers and their websites and their people who write for them and such, it's not just the Ted Cruz in Mexico, but like that the issue with this bill is not what's inside of it. It's the size of it has been most of the debate that I have noticed.
That was delightful wordplay, Matt Welch.
Okay. it's more of like the macro question of like, yeah, we really need to go big this time. But it's like, what's in the bill? What are you doing? What is that process by which we get that journalistic result, which is so unsatisfying in normal newspapers?
I think a lot of it is because the conversation is about who is winning and who is losing rather than about what's actually in the bill or what's going to happen. And we don't care who's winning or who's losing. We want them both to lose. We want everyone in Washington to lose if at all possible. So that question isn't interesting to us. The question that is interesting to us is what is going to happen to individual Americans? What is going to happen to our economy? I think the place where this is the most interesting or where it's playing out the most interestingly to me is the question of the $15 minimum wage, which, speaking of things in the coronavirus package that really have nothing to do with coronavirus, a $15 minimum wage is in there right now. And in fact, may wind up being the sticking point about whether that bill gets passed, whether Biden's first big legislative initiative goes through, because God bless him, there are two sort of annoying moderate Democrats who have said, who have gone on the record and said, a $15 minimum wage is not an appropriate thing to put into a coronavirus relief package. And those are Joe Manchin, who seems to be getting all of the love and attention because he's like, I don't know, John McCain, but for moderate Democrats or something, I guess. But
he's the last of the blue dogs.
Okay, like, fine. But the person who I am far more interested in because she's awesome is Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona. Incredible style icon and legit Arizona politician in that she's bringing something a little bit different than the garbage tribal sort of, you know, you vote with your caucus or go die vibes that the rest of the Democrats are bringing to this process right now. That's what they're trying to do this week is convince those two that they should look the other way on the $15 minimum wage. And I don't think it's going to work. And I hope that it gets removed from the bill. But that is like four layers down in the coverage of this, because nobody can be bothered to think about what's really in there and what it might mean for Americans after.
They also have to convince the parliamentarian.
Peter,
it's right. So it's you have to get all the Democrats and the
parliamentarian. Yeah, there's a whole like bird, like somehow like it's always bird. Like it's always the bird rule. Every rule is the bird rule. I don't understand. Everything's named after bird. But yes, somehow.
I want the magic rule instead of the bird rule. Enough East Coast bias.
What does that mean, Matt? That's showtime all the time?
That's exactly right. Peter, this all calls to mind, to me anyways, the way my bad mind works. Great piece that you did for us also about 10 years ago. Called a Medicare whack-a-mole in the following way. You made the point that Medicare is a system. Would you stop laughing? Go mute yourself.
It's like such a simpler America.
He's filled with joy.
We're talking about
Matt,
whack-a-mole.
That was a giggle of joy.
Was the headline of the piece.
Matt Welch had that thing about Czechoslovakian ski ball. You know, those were glorious days.
At any rate, Peter Suderman, that the Medicare system is basically designed to send checks into people's pockets. It is kind of in its own way shovel ready. It's a check writing machine. And that's where you get fraud. The waste, fraud, and abuse that everyone's always going after in Medicare is impossible because you're sending out checks. So here's my convoluted question to you is, if we were demanding that this $1.9 trillion thing go out right now into shovel ready, help us from coronavirus or whatever stuff, would we not see a bunch of waste, fraud, and abuse? Does speed become graft?
Well, it depends on exactly how you're going to spend it, I think is the answer. And it also depends on what you want to define as graft. And so with Medicare, Medicare is making payments for services rendered. And so that means that people are charging Medicare for something that they have at least in theory done. In some cases, in the most overt examples of fraud, they're charging Medicare for something that they have not done at all. And that happens in some ways. It happens with Medicare and with Medicaid. There are some just like hilarious actually hilarious congressional testimonies from Medicare and Medicaid fraudsters who just like got an address in a strip mall in Florida and registered for a number and then started asking for money for stuff that they were doing. And the government was just like, okay, we'll give you the money. And there's like, I mean, you know, there have been investigations into this by the Government Accountability Office where the Government Accountability Office investigators in Washington call the Medicare folks like two doors down and just convince them to give them the registration number so they can start billing. And it's just incredible. And so that sort of thing is not exactly what we're talking about when we're talking about a program that just sends checks to people. It's not graft in that sort of like really classic fraud sense. But what you do end up having is what we've talked about before, which is checks going to families with totally stable jobs that make well into six figures, $140,000 or $150,000 a year. People who have had no significant, on average, not just them, not just individuals, but on average, groups that have had no significant job disruption. And then also money going to states that not only didn't have drops in their revenue for the year that were predicted, but instead, like California is looking at a $15 billion budget surplus. And yet Biden's plan would send California a whole bunch of money. So again, that's not classic fraud, but it's totally, I mean, I think it's completely fair to classify it as waste, even though a GAO report might not. And so you just get all of this money that's spent on stuff that we don't need to spend on. And, you know, part of the thing, if you think about that, it's also just like defeats the purpose of stimulus. Let's say that you are just a true believer in Keynesian stimulus, right? What you want is to help the economy by pumping money into the economy that gets spent. If you give money to families that are doing real well, or at least pretty well, and are racking up huge amounts of savings, what is the most likely outcome of that? It's that they're just going to pile up more savings. If you give money to states that have budget surpluses, what is the most likely result of that? They're going to wait years to spend that money. You're not going to get a stimulus effect out of that because that money is just going to go sit somewhere and not circulate through the economy.
Yes, Nick?
I think the best way to understand this bill is, you know, as a culmination of a longer term trend towards a new mode of governing. And this has been a long time coming, but for the entirety of the 21st century, the point of government has been the federal government has to spend more and more money on more and more things. And this kind of jacks it up, it ratchets up because of the COVID emergency, but this is putting money in the pockets of everybody. It is like a, Frank Sinatra going to the Sands and walking around the floor and giving, you know, a dollar here, $10 here, $100 here to different service people to keep them happy so that when he starts, having his goons smash food in the face of women that he's no longer sleeping with, everything's cool. This is the new normal. This is it. You know, and this is the new governing model. And it's been Republicans, it's been Democrats. I've been spending a lot of time over the past week going back to those halcyon days of the early Bush, George W. Bush years. And, you know, he just spent money on fucking everything and all over the place. We're there now. And the biggest difference is that the constraint on the idea, well, we might run out of money or we might have too much debt. We might, there was a philosophical and an economic policy argument being made about, you know, spending too much on too many things. There were occasionally, also concerns about the effects of free government money on people's behavior, on industries' behaviors, et cetera. All of that has disappeared, essentially. And now it is mostly a question of, how do I get mine? And, you know, how do I get as much or a little bit more or only a little bit less than everybody else? And that's why this isn't a stimulus bill, as Peter is talking about. This isn't about fixing the economy, which is, you know, most projections now are that we've got a good shot at, you know, a 5% annual growth rate this year. It'll go down next year, you know, because there's going to be whenever we decide, okay, we're done with this, let's all go out, there's going to be a bunch of economic activity from pent-up demand. This is not about stimulus spending. This is about the new model of federal governance, which is just to spend and spend and spend without restraint. And you can see this, the Republicans are not offering up a serious philosophical opposition to this. It is, you know, how do we, you know, how do we make sure our guys are getting what they need to?
The backdrop to all this obviously is COVID, coronavirus, and the great news about all of that is that the virus is going down literally everywhere. All 50 states, District of Columbia, all countries in the world, it's plummeting. It's going down. It's been going down since before the vaccines. Basically, since the January peak, it's going down. The awful news continues to be we just passed the 500,000 death mark in the United States, which is just appalling. But it, you know, there's now arguments about what does that jubilee that Nick was referring to look like? When does it start? There's a piece in the Wall Street Journal a couple of days ago saying that we might have herd immunity by the end of April. My God, there's some various discussions. Robbie Suave had a piece this morning where Dr. Anthony Fauci was talking about we still might be wearing masks in 2022. So I guess my kind of vague question is, what does this look like to all of us thinking about the future? What's going to change? What should change in terms of how government should change policy in a rapidly getting better universe? And also, like, how should we all behave? Catherine, when are you going to rip off the mask is what I'm saying.
I mean, I think, not to give a super lame answer to your question, but here I go. I'll probably keep wearing a mask in some places and also remove it in many others, and have, once I am vaccinated in particular, I will have other people who are vaccinated into my home, and we will behave completely normally without masks and such. And that is going to be absolutely awesome. I think it's bizarre. And this was my entire Twitter timeline this morning. It is bizarre that public health officials have not put together the very, very simple equation. If you think that the highest good right now is to convince people to get vaccines, and I think in general, the public health establishment agrees that that is the best use of our resources and our best hope for returning to normal. Why? Why in God's name would you be saying anything other than, once you are vaccinated, you will be protected from the worst ravages of the coronavirus, and you should look forward to going back to normal life? That's such an obvious, simple message. And I get that there's a bunch of CYA going on. I get that there's a bunch of caution because the vaccine is not available to everyone. And so overhyping it, I suppose, in theory, could backfire. But all signs point to the fact that what we need to do right now, what Dr. Fauci can do right now, is convince people to demand and follow the steps to receive a vaccine. And it's crazy to me that people are out here saying, like, well, still continued masking everywhere until 2023 or whatever it is. No, my mom is getting her second dose of the vaccine and she is going to come hug all the grandchildren. That is the pitch.
Would
That's
you
the
allow
pitch.
Matt the Welch end. To hug your children when he gets his second dose? Catherine?
Never in any times, normal, coronavirus,
yeah,
otherwise.
Fairness, I've had opportunities and that was just never encouraged.
Well, sometimes, Matt, you have to make
you
history.
Know, we were...
You can't just let it wait for you.
Make her story. Peter, are you going to walk around with a I got vaccinated sweatshirt when you go to the bar? I got to say, Peter, I was in a... New York just opened, the city finally opened up its indoor dining, and I went out
so
a
Arby's...
Times.
And what, Nathan's? What else?
Bubba Gump Shrimp
Arby's.
Co.
Yeah,
they
have
the meats. You know, you can talk shit about Arby's, but they do have the meats.
And where I come from, a black cow milkshake. Oh, yeah.
No, Arby's
Someone
is
has
the
probably
Jamoca.
Said to Matt in earnest at some point, sir, this is an Arby's.
It's absolutely true. Peter, so I was in a restaurant and behind me, there was a band that was playing music. And it was so great, and it had this terrible effect on me that my wife is now worried, and family broadly, which is that, like, oh, cool, that's what that's like. I'm over this. I'm over every aspect. I went from zero to Jeffrey Tucker in like 5 seconds. I just wanted to be so done with everything, put on the bow tie, get a little dip in, just the whole kit and caboodle. So how's Suderman thinking about bars is what I'm saying.
Well, I don't think I'm ready to put on a bow tie, but I'm ready to go back to some bars pretty soon here, as soon as I can get vaccinated. I think that once you're vaccinated, there's no reason to not go about life as normal. I think you do need to kind of respect cultural norms about masking. There's no reason to be rude about it. And masking in a at least partially, if not mostly, symbolic way, is masking is going to be around for a while. But I think other stuff is just going to start to come back online. And as to your question about policy, I think... that's really the place where sort of we need to focus here, which is sometime between April and July or so, the vaccine supply is going to start to outstrip demand. We're going to be in a situation where every American, more or less, who wants to get vaccinated can sign up and do so. Maybe not tomorrow, but like in a 2 week period. Once that happens, there is absolutely no excuse for state governors and mayors who have closed stuff down to say that things have to be closed anymore. Every single thing needs to open at the point that people can get vaccinated when they want to. And we are very, very close to that point. And we should probably start the reopening process in big cities that have shut down, in California, which is still just crazily locked down in ways that I think people who don't live there don't completely understand. And maybe Nick can speak to that more than me. I have not been there, but talking to people and looking at our reporting on California's rules and restrictions, it's just crazy what's going on out there, what has been going on out there for a full year. And you compare it to a state like Florida, where they have just been much more open, and the results have not been have not shown that California's policies really work and Florida's really don't. In fact, if anything, they have tended to suggest the otherwise. Now, again, there's a bunch of variant factors here, right? And coronavirus works in a weird way that we don't completely understand. But I think just the policy question here is really obvious. When people get vaccinated, cities and states should open up and should simply say, restaurants, 100% capacity, go and bump elbows at a bar if you want to. We are not going to make a big deal out of this anymore. And schools need to reopen immediately. I mean, I think they should be open already. But again, at the point that we can all get vaccinated, states, cities, mayors, governors, they just need to step back and say, look, we're done with this.
I think I agree with what everybody is saying. And I actually think it can start before vaccinations are reached at a certain place. But I think what we need to look at and what we need to keep on guard against and what we need to continue to track going forward is what Giorgio Agamben, the Italian Foucauldian social critic who was pilloried a year ago when in an Italian context, he said the lockdowns that were going through Italy and other parts of the world make manifest the growing tendency to use the state of exception as a normal governing paradigm. Matt Welch, what you may recall that we wrote a book together. Nice. I don't know if either of us ever read it, but we talked about governing by crisis. What Agamben, and I'm mispronouncing his name on purpose because that way it's, you know, it foregrounds the construction of meaning in a way I think he would find pleasing, to be quite honest. But what he's talking about is that the state is always claiming something horrible is going on, so we need to take more control of everyday life, of autonomy, of individual relations, of business, or whatever. You know, it can be terrorism, it can be a pandemic, it can be geopolitical, a natural disaster, it can be all sorts of things. And just as I was saying that, I think, you know, what the $1.9 trillion bill you know, is actually about is that this is cementing. This is the, you know, the crowning jewel of decades of a move away from one type of government spending to another model. We are going to be in a state of exception, or politicians and many people in with throughout the culture are going to be saying we need to stay in a state of exception, to use Agamben's phrase. And that's, you know, it's not going to go away. And that's why you hear people like Fauci saying, oh, yeah, we're going to need to keep wearing masks in 2022. And we're going to have to do this, and we're going to have to do that. We're going to have to continue to have people like Andrew Cuomo, you know, write up lists of what are essential businesses and what aren't, because at some point we may have to, you know, start deciding this and that. There is going to be, you know, when the virus is gone, we will still have to go through the territory. We'll have to go through all of the battlefield and make sure that, you know, we have cleared out all of the vestiges of what has been put into place in the past year and many people have gotten comfortable with or actually buy into. And you know, and first and foremost, schools are the battlefield that really needs to be completely pacified.
Just very super briefly, one example of that is our immigration policy, where we published a big piece on the site last week by David Beer, where he described the ways in which coronavirus, you know, gave Trump cover for a very aggressive restrictionism and is also still giving Biden cover for mealy-mouthed, slow-rolled reform. And, you know, just one tiny example of the places that you might not think to look when you are out clearing the mines that we put down during coronavirus. There is metering at the border for people seeking asylum, justified in part on coronavirus grounds, on top of just straight border closures in lots of other places. That is the kind of thing we're going to have to untangle, and it's going to be really hard.
Yeah, and just as to the when things get back to normal question, I think the thing that is going to take the longest time to get back to normal is international travel. And that's not just the United States, it's Europe, which has put a bunch of travel restrictions in place that are not going to disappear this summer and are not going to disappear even when most of the United States is vaccinated, in part because, like we were talking about earlier, Europe is going to end up vaccinating much, much more slowly than the United States.
All right, we're going to get to our listener question of the week in a moment. But first, are you one of the millions of people out there suffering here at the end of winter from depression, stress, anxiety, insomnia, or substance abuse? If so, please consider seeking out betterhelp.com/roundtable. Betterhelp.com, that's H-E-L-P. To help get you out of H-E-L-L, gives you instant confidential access to a network of licensed mental health professionals in all 50 states. Go to their website, betterhelp.com/roundtable. Describe your issues and needs and preferred delivery systems, and you'll be set up with someone to talk to within 24 hours. If you don't like that first counselor, you can switch them out. Financial assistance is also available. That's betterhelp.com/roundtable. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. Okay, it's time for our listener question of the week. You can send your queries via email at roundtable@reason.com or by voicemail, 213-973-3017. Please tell us how you wish to be identified and if you have any social media stuff. Today's cue comes from Jeffrey Evans, who writes, and I really like this first sentence. Hi, Reason. I love your podcast. It's my favorite listen of the week. That's how you get your thing right, people. Just, you know, put the butter on the toast. My issue is this, continues Jeffrey. I really want to support Facebook, Twitter, etc. as private companies and their right to moderate their users however they see fit. And I do. However, in a world where their CEOs are being hauled in to address Congress every few weeks, it seems, and with the clear implied threat of congressional regulation if they do not comply with the whims of various representatives, isn't this crossing the line into a First Amendment issue? At what point is this no longer an issue of private corporations acting as they please, and more of a de facto government restriction on speech? Have we already crossed that line, Catherine?
My guy Jeffrey gets it. That's a good question. He's basically right that that is the question people should be asking. And it's annoying that is the question that literally no one is asking anywhere, except for hopefully here on the Reason podcast and in the pages of Reason. Yeah. So I think this like the question of how much of the regulation of speech, how much of the constriction of speech on the social media platforms is preemptive self-censorship because of fear of government action is a huge one. I think, though, that the specific question that Jeffrey asks of, I want to support private companies' rights, but, I would say you have to, the way out of this is to point the finger at Congress and point the finger at the government officials in the various bureaucracies that are creating this chilling or speech hostile environment, and not point the finger at Facebook for that specific First Amendment violation. I think you still have to say private companies should be allowed to do whatever they want to do. And then there is the separate question, should we be hauling the CEOs of several social media companies in front of Congress to sort of vaguely threaten them or butter them up alternately until they do what people with the power to fine or jail those CEOs want them to do, put that one on the shoulder of the government. So I think you do not have to say we have reached a perfect equilibrium in a free market of speech when Twitter shadow bans Peter Suderman, though obviously that is a perfect equilibrium and should be achieved. What you can
I'm
say
looking
is
forward to it more than anyone else.
It's kind of the natural state
what
of
you
things.
Can say is we have to protect the rights of these companies to do whatever moderation, to do business with whatever people they want to do business with or not. That is a vital fundamental right. And then separately, we have to address the absolutely poisonous way that this conversation is going down because government officials think they can bully these companies through sort of soft power means.
I would argue that I agree that it's a fantastic question. And I also think on a meta level, the next kind of great iteration of libertarian thought really has to start, we've talked about this in various contexts, kind of go into more of a Neal Stephenson space of what is a world like where corporate power and government power are not that clearly distinguishable, in reality or the way things play out. We need to update assumptions that were first made in, the 17th century, 18th, 19th, 20th century to deal with, a kind of weirder, more hybridized way of going about everything in the world. Having said this, on this particular issue, I don't see any evidence that, idiots who are asking Mark Zuckerberg, how to fix their iPhone in congressional hearings are driving policy at Facebook in the same way that mid-level employees at Facebook and at Twitter and at Amazon and elsewhere are driving the conversation, and that the threat to actual free speech, within these platforms, we all agree that they're private platforms, they have a right to kick off every idiot they want. I hope that they unshadow ban Peter Suderman. I think he deserves at least as big a readership as Diamond and Silk, who are hard to find these days on all of these platforms. But, the problem to speech and the problem to crappy shadow banning, actual banning, and a locking down of free speech on social media is fully the problem of people within these companies, which are like countries now. I don't see any evidence that the government leaning on these people is doing it. Did Twitter not run the New York Post Hunter Biden story, because they were worried that Joe Biden was going to come into office and shut them down? No, it's because they were ideologically simpatico with Joe Biden winning. And I think that's a much bigger threat. Did Amazon bounce their contract with Woody Allen because they were worried the government's going to be upset that he's going to do, a cuties franchise for him? No. So I think the problem right now with speech restrictions online has to do with people in those companies.
If somebody called me into a congressional hearing once a month to just ask me some questions about the editorial policy of Reason Magazine,
what would you do?
It would have a chilling effect on me. It would scare the bejesus out of me for
emboldened.
The future of the
you would,
thing.
You would rise
that
up
I value
like the She-Hulk of free speech.
Have invested a lot in. And while I love to hear myself called the She-Hulk of free speech, I genuinely love it, I think it is disingenuous to say that those hearings and the associated massive amounts of regulatory compliance and lobbying spending and all, those hearings are just the visual centerpiece of a web of interactions between these social media companies and the state that is not healthy.
What's the role of the ideological, you know, predispositions of these platforms in deciding suddenly, okay, you know what, free speech, yes, free speech, not? How much of it is, to the extent that they're currying favor, I don't think it's because of restrictions. It's because of ideological simpatico stuff. And
that's something we should defend. I would like to have all kinds of speech have places to have an airing, but luckily it does. I mean, Parler is back online, for instance, after a month's hiatus due to the fact that those dudes seem to be like coding with blindfolds on while drunk or something. But like, even Parler is back online. Clubhouse exists. You know, there are so many places to speak online. I believe now, I have always believed, I think it is very applicable in this case, that the solution to some places, for whatever reason, ideological or otherwise, metering and restricting certain speech is to find other places where that speech is allowed. And luckily, unlike the government, they have no power over you. You can just leave. You can just walk away from the cluster of speech from the private companies that are doing a thing you don't like and go do the thing you want to do somewhere else. And I know that there are some that currently are dominant in the marketplace, but those, you know, that type of dominance doesn't last forever, as all of us who have stopped going on Facebook know.
Peter, to tee up.
So Substack is just the language of the shadow band?
Yes.
Substack is the language of the shadow band.
Peter, I, as you formulate your reaction to your two colleagues, I would invite you to at least think about taking one lane, which is maybe, just maybe, the executives of Facebook, Twitter, et al., maybe they like going in front of Congress. Maybe they like being pressured, because then maybe they write the rules, man.
Well, I don't know that they like going in front of Congress, but I think that that's the right point to make here and to add into this is it's not entirely clear how congressional pressure works in these cases, right? So Catherine says if she were hauled in front of Congress to talk about reasons editorial choices, there would be a chilling effect. I think that's totally right. But what would the questions be, right? And what if they are, as in the case of Facebook and Twitter, what if the questions are, hey, why are you running this article? Hey, why aren't you running more of that article? Like back to back, which is what happens, which is Twitter is being criticized on the one hand for being too restrictive, and on the other hand for being for not banning enough stuff, right? And Facebook even more so.
Or actually, strictly speaking, I think the questions would be, Catherine, why did this article appear in Mother Jones? Like right. That actually is how those hearings
right.
go.
How do so. I download? How do I read this PDF on my Kindle? Right. Yeah. I don't understand. It's and so I think there is an interaction there, and I think it's a mistake to say that Congress has no role and no influence. But the thing that worries me is what you were talking about, Matt, is that the leaders now are going of these tech companies are going in front of Congress. And as Catherine said, they're also doing a lot of back channel work that is not visible in these hearings, where they are pressuring legislators to put rules in place and to, you know, if you need some help writing some legislative language, we've got a staff full of highly competent, highly paid professionals who are willing to do that because they want two things. One, they want rules that insulate them, right? That sort of not just insulate them. They want rules that Facebook in particular wants rules that make Facebook a kind of a utility, right? A company that is just sort of going to be protected, right? Where it's like competitors aren't going to be able to spring up, where like maybe the rules exert some cost on them, but small organizations are not going to be able to pop up and compete with Facebook. They want rules that look like that. But the other thing is they want rules in place so they can say, look, our hands are tied. These aren't our decisions. It's not our fault. Because what Facebook, I think, really clearly, at least at the sort of very high leadership level, maybe not in the mid-level staffer level, but at the very high leadership level, they want to just be able to say, look, we don't have any choice in this matter. The government did this for us, you know, made us do this. And it's and so we want to be blameless and we want to not have to decide on our own what we're going to do with our algorithms and our speech rules and our banning and our shadow banning and whatever other terms for banning we have here, because Facebook doesn't want to be the one that everybody hates. They want to be the one that just provides the service and plays by the rules that they wrote to insulate them from competition and to ensure that 30 years from now, Facebook is, you know, is a federal department of Don Jr.'s administration. Sorry.
What a chilling vision of a chronicle foretold.
I want to unsee his facial stubble over and over again. I don't know what that means. Let's go to our end of podcast, what we have been consuming in the cultural sphere, because I do believe that there is some discussion that will be spun off from some of our choices, beginning with Peter Suderman. What have you been consuming, Peter?
So I watched Nomadland, which is a new movie directed by Chloe Zhao, who is a young filmmaker. This is her third film. It is a sort of docudrama-ish. I think that's not maybe, she doesn't like that term, but there's a little bit of, her movies use non-traditional actors playing kind of themselves. And this is, and then in this film, she's also got Frances McDormand and David Strathairn, who are actors and who you might know. And there's a little bit more plot here. But this is a movie about somebody who is sort of living in a van and living the van life, running around the country as an older, not quite ready to retire person. And there's just so much to unpack in this film. So I actually just won't say too much about it, except that I was moved beyond words in a way that I almost never am. And it's just easily the best thing I have seen since movie theaters shut down. It's beautiful. It's just tremendously affecting in a way that, like, it's actually hard to talk about. And it gets at the dignity and value of work, the myth of the American West, the sort of the ways that work is also not the only thing that we want out of life, right? It's beautiful and affecting, and I can't recommend it enough. It's a movie I just haven't been able to stop thinking about for 48 hours now.
Catherine, I think he almost went for Klemptonus there, Catherine. Go ahead, Nick.
Oh, I was going to say, I also watched it last night, and I agree completely with Peter's reaction to it. I almost thought about it in terms of the two points I'll make. One is that it almost takes place, and geographically, it's kind of located in the broad regions of America that Napoleon Dynamite was set in. It takes place in a harsh landscape, but ultimately a forgiving and loving universe.
Yeah, it's an extremely humane film. And
it's not about politics. It's not about ideology. There's any number of moments where it could take a ton of cheap shots one way or the other. And what it focuses on is older people who have been forced into lives that they might not have wanted, but then make the best or most intentional choices they can. It's beautiful.
There's like a monologue about how capitalism is bad, you know, at a pivotal point early in the film, right? And you sort of wonder, oh, is this just going to be a movie about? And then no, it's like actually the movie shows McDormand. It has incredible footage from inside an Amazon warehouse, which is really quite unusual, an actual Amazon warehouse where the character is supposedly working seasonally, and it really is not a film that like overtly is sort of takes a side in the political or cultural, you know, sort of battles of today. Instead, it just sort of says that people all have hard lives and make hard choices, and that the way that they find meaning is by searching for it themselves and by coming together with other people to do the same.
I was going to say that the director as well is Chinese American. And what is fascinating is that, I mean, there are some people of color in this, but it's overwhelmingly older white Americans. And it is, you could see things being reversed where people would be like, who the fuck is this person to tell these stories? And it's so beautiful that a 38-year-old immigrant to America made this unbelievably, deeply American story.
Wow. Catherine, you can't follow that up, but try.
I really can't, I have to say. I guess I'll go watch Nomadland, but I read a collection of short stories. I read this collection of short stories against my own better instincts. It is called Homesick for Another World. It's by Otessa Mashvega. She wrote, among other books, My Year of Rest and Relaxation. Her writing is so incredibly powerful and always in the direction of making me feel like filthy and depressed. So I'm not exactly sure what my plan was in reading a collection of short stories that make me feel like I need a shower with a Brillo pad and doing so in late February during a pandemic. It's dark, y'all. But I do think, you know, her skill as a writer is undeniable. I've gone back for more despite hating how I feel after reading her books because she's so good. And this is it. This is a collection of stories about people who have just made terrible choices in their lives after looking those terrible choices straight in the eye and just saying, like, yes, that. I want to choose this bad choice because I just don't care what other people think about my choices at all. So if you are just having a real late February depression moment and you want to lean into it, Odessa Mosh Vega in any of her guises, but especially
I'm a huge fan, and I just love the kind of the bodily grossness of her work, that she just leans into the mucus of everything, right? It's just like, and you read it and you just like feel like you've been bathing in like week old piss jello or something.
Ah, why? You just made it even worse.
No, I mean,
it is also people who...
I'm on a ketone diet.
It is also people who, to be clear, are failing on every level in a way that's fascinating. Like, they are failing professionally, personally. Their health is degenerating for no reason other than that they cannot be bothered to, like, eat food and see the sun.
And she's also, like, our age. She's, like, in her late 30s.
Nick... what not our age consumption have you been doing?
So, well, the main thing that I watch, or what I was going to talk about, was The Test Kitchen, which is an unintentionally hilarious parody of wokeism. That is a special series under the Reply All podcast of Gimlet Media. And it's a bunch of people, some will remember that last summer, Bon Appetit, the Condé Nast magazine, that, you know, is really so important to everybody's life, was revealed to be a hotbed of white supremacism and horror show, you know, kind of management tendencies and things like that. So this is about that, and it's done by a young producer who, you know, pulls out all of the, she says she talked to some of the white people who were the problem in the test kitchen at Bon Appetit, people like Adam Rappaport, the editor who got fired after an old Halloween picture of him dressed up as like a Puerto Rican gang member or something like that surfaced. She talked to him, but she only actually uses the voices of people of color in the show because that's, you know, like, you know, people like Adam Rappaport have obviously always been talking, blah, blah, blah. So it's a litany of human resource complaints of people bitching and moaning about how shitty it was to work at this place. And it's oftentimes things like a Mexican employee, a guy, is told, well, you know, they're making recipes in the test kitchen, and they're like, well, you can do Mexican stuff because, you know, you're Mexican and that's what you grew up eating and you're interested in that. And, you know, people, and the hostess of this podcast sighs all the time, like, can you believe? And it's,
wait, sighs on a podcast?
Yeah,
no, a lot?
That's why I started sighing.
Yeah,
that. I started sighing as like an unacknowledged, like, riff off of that. But she, you know, she's so outraged, and you know, and the guys, you know, it's like, oh, I, you know, so this place is so racist that they make the Mexicans do all the Mexican food. But then literally the next story in the first episode is a woman of Chinese descent saying, I wanted to make soup dumplings,
she's
and
Taiwanese,
they wouldn't,
yeah,
let me do soup dumplings. They made me do spaghetti bolognese, and they gave, like, years later or something, they gave a white woman, like, go do the soup dumplings. And, like, the narrator of the podcast isn't like, okay, so is it, you know, what's worse? Is it racist to assume, you know, you're Mexican, so you do Mexican food, or is it to say you're Chinese, but why don't you try an Italian dish or whatever? And it, I just recommend, you know, years ago, The Onion did a great parody of Serial called A Very Fatal Murder, which was, it's like the way the Colbert Report was a perfect parody as well as representation of the O'Reilly Factor. So, you know, you didn't have to listen to the O'Reilly Factor anymore because you could get that show's content and a critique of it all at the same time. The Test Kitchen is, I mean, it is a parody beyond words. And then what the greatest thing about it is, so it's all about these, you know, we have to cancel these people who were canceled, like Condé Nast, and they're terrible, terrible. The host of the podcast and one of the hosts of Reply All ended up getting canceled because they did this show. And then other people who had worked with them were like, you know, these pieces of shit were really unsupportive of the attempt to unionize Gimlet Media. So they both, last week, they both resigned. So this podcast, this podcast is like watching The Ring, you know, the Japanese horror movie. Like, if you listen to it within 72 hours, you will be canceled for some reason that you can't fully understand. But listen to The Test Kitchen. It is great.
Nick and I have like just a couple days left then in our time at Reason, because I listened to it as well and was struck by exactly the same thing, though you definitely just committed not one but two microaggressions in your description, since the second person that you described was Taiwanese also that she was told to make lasagna, not spaghetti. So
but it was a bolognese, right? I'm Italian, so you know, all pasta dishes, you know, they're all mother to me.
You're anti-Italian. But yes, the incredible way in which this podcast was just, I mean, it was genuinely a description of a workplace that sounded unpleasant for many of the people that worked there.
Like
to the extent that was like the project here is like, yeah, okay, like I can get how being like a junior person working as a recipe tester in the test kitchen on an hourly wage kind of maybe sucked, but also like, okay, you know, that's... And to be fair to that podcast, I would say the host, she recognizes that she's feeling her way through something that she can't rationally argue for. And so she says over and over, people are still trying to sort out their thoughts about this, even so many years later. And it's like, yeah, you know who else is still trying to sort out their thoughts about this? You, it seems, like in real time during this podcast and not succeeding. But yes, the canceling of the chroniclers of the canceling, just like
it's so Robespierre, it hurts.
I
and as someone who loved Rappaport's Bon Appetit, which we've talked about on this podcast, loved it. Honestly, felt that it was like an incredibly awesome, high quality product. I think that was given short shrift in this accounting of things. It was like this guy, he came in and he did all this stuff, but was it good? And it was like, yeah, the product was really, really good. And like, also, Adam Rappaport did not invent cooking magazines being racist. Like, it's not as if before Rappaport, there was like a diverse, you know, Benetton ad of bylines in Bon Appetit or anywhere else.
I would also add that part of my enjoyment in all of this is that it's also a further sign that Condé Nast as an empire is, you know, it's the Ottoman Empire in the 19th century. It is finished. You know, and it's like it can't end quick enough. You know, push it down. It's made of paper mache and get on and do your own stuff. You know, and that is kind of happening to some of the people from Bon Appetit as well as other properties there at the New York Times or, you know, these other, you know, edifices, you know, these ruins that still populate the, you know, the kind of journalistic or cultural skyline.
Who will be the Ataturk of Condé Nast?
Yeah.
I think is the question that we all have to think of ourselves. I'm just trying to decide what is the absolute worst subculture for this type of purity spirals and circular firing squads, whether it's food journalism, young adult fiction, or like yarn or knitting. I forget which one of those two like went completely off the rails.
The best part about when it's food journalism is like, They talked, like in this podcast, they talked around it a bit, but there is a point where you just have to say at the center of this story where people are bringing like really strong emotions and big politics and like intractable social issues, you just have to say the words soup dumplings. Like it's about dumplings.
My God, I didn't realize the stakes were so high.
You have to admit that, like, in the middle of these conversations,
it's
in
like
a way.
It's like the cosmic cube or like one of the infinity stones, you know? Yeah.
That's a good segue, Nick. Thanks for it. Because my culture, what I've been consuming, is that for 9 months with my 12-year-old, we watched the entire Marvel Cinematic Universe in chronological timeline order. In addition to a bunch of probably like a dozen, maybe 20 TV episodes, mostly Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., but a little bit of Agent Carter as well.
Did you do the WandaVision, Matt Welch?
No. So we were all set up. We just finished this weekend the Spider-Man post-Endgame movie, and now we're going to watch WandaVision, which I'm looking forward to very much. But completed this thing, took a long time, have some thoughts. And then in an unrelated maneuver, as I was trying to listen to music to console myself for how long it was taking to put together a mail order bed for said 12-year-old, and also had to be after having read my favorite music journalist, Stephen Hayden, came out with, you know, one of these Up Rocks lists of the 50 best Led Zeppelin songs in order, which he does pretty spectacularly well. I listened to all of Led Zeppelin's records in order, which is just 8, which I'd listened to a lot when I was a teenager. And I came up with this stoner thought, which is the MCU and Led Zeppelin are the same.
I'll buy that. Except you were shitting on Hats Off to Roy Harper over the weekend.
Well, you know, Iron Man 2 sucked too. Yeah. You know, that's just, there's going to be individual bits that don't do it. But like they're similar in that they're just massively successful. MCU wasn't pooped on by critics as much as Led Zeppelin was, but it's just, it's to this day, it's astonishing how much in real time everyone, all the learned rock critics were like, oh, Led Zeppelin's terrible.
Does the Marvel Cinematic Universe have satanic undercurrents, as does all of Led Zeppelin's music? How many people swore to, you know, became legions of Satan after watching Avengers movie, compared to all of us who listen to In Through the Outdoor?
There's some Satan stuff in the MCU, and there's also some Hobbit. And I mean, they actually use the Immigrant Song for Thor, right?
I mean,
there's
I liked the Thor movies, how together. Asgard finally got a black member, but he's literally the doorman. He's like, okay, yeah, you can walk across the bridge to Asgard. I also found myself watching Avengers movie, the last two, and I was disappointed that Take Your Daughter to Work Day is in April, because I wanted to make Thanos brings his daughter to work, you know?
Yeah, it's very true. There's a MCU gets a little bit more like parenting in there. For sure, than Led Zeppelin. Wasn't a very parent-heavy rock.
What was your favorite of the Marvel movies, Matt?
Oh my God, that's incredible.
Who's Thanos? Peter Grant, the manager of Led Zeppelin, is
Thanos. He is Thanos, I mean, and Galactus, because he could eat whole planets, too.
He did such terrible genocides in the 1970s, you don't even want to.
Galactus definitely killed like half of Lynyrd Skynyrd, right? He's responsible for that.
Although Ghost Rider, right? That's the Satan. That's more of an Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. jam. We'll
get to that someday. What does your daughter like about the Marvel universe?
It's funny. Like right now, she's kind of she's sort of done with it. But she liked Wanda always from the get go. I think because she was related to the actors that played in Full House.
Yeah, absolutely.
She's the sister, so that was her entree. But she also liked her as a character. Yeah, one of the twins, Olsen.
Well, your wife is part Sokovian, isn't she, Matt Welch?
No, she ultimately is a an Endgame stan, Infinity War Endgame. Which are the physical graffiti of the.
So are you and her both excited about Black Widow coming out? I mean, is this like a big deal? Since you've been going
yes,
through
nobody's and probably is, for me
nobody
for
is
me
excited
more
about
because
that.
Black Widow and along with Hawkeye are my favorite characters.
Oh my god, Matt Welch. Hawkeye.
Terrible choices. What?
Yeah. Jeez. They're flawed. They're self-made. They have
should we check real quick about other people's favorite, cuz like obviously I'm team Loki,
yeah.
but like
yeah, everyone's Loki.
Yeah, but like Loki Stan.
So who is Loki
like
in Led Zeppelin, though? Is it John Paul Jones? It can't be John
Led
Paul
Zeppelin.
Jones.
It's just...
Bonzo Bonham?
I guess it just doesn't have an analog, sadly. Maybe Sandy Denny.
There's like yeah. not enough Led Zeppelin to go around to cover
what
the
is
whole
your,
MCU, it seems to me.
What's
but
your
what
favorite
do I know?
Led Zeppelin record, Matt Welch, album and song?
Physical Graffiti, by far, which it was before, and it's the only one that I listen to on purpose anymore, ever, and it still holds up because it doesn't have a bad song on it, but In the Light is one of the only, I mean, Robert Plant is one of the worst lyricists who's ever fouled the universe, but In the Light is a rare, moving, beautiful kind of coda, to use a word.
Predictable, and it's certainly not interesting. But I'm the Led Zeppelin record I listen to, and I'm like, I want to listen to Led Zeppelin. It's Led Zeppelin 3.
Yeah,
and I love the Gallows Pole, which is the dumbest song and production, and it's like, wait, we've got a couple more strings we can stretch on something and throw in at the end, and let's then take so everything and just throw it down the stairwell, you know, and see what happens.
That's all the hangmanning that we have time for here on the Reason Roundtable.
Steel Man, that hangman.
Steel Man, the hangman. Podcast. Look at all of our podcast outlets, offerings, at Reason.com podcast, including Nick Gillespie's recent interview with Nick Gillespie on Wednesdays. And Soho
yeah,
Farm.
Thanos. We've got Thanos coming up this week.
That's
he's
good.
He's going to talk about workplace harassment issues that have been dogging him for, I don't know, millennia.
Thanos' soup dumpling recipe coming up on the next Reason podcast.
Agrarian reform. He's really into that.
He has got back to the garden. Yeah.
That's it. If you're listening to this on Monday, which you should, because that's when it's released, I'm going on the Kennedy program tonight at 8 o'clock, which Reason people do often because Kennedy's great. She's our friend. That's it. Thanks. Goodbye.